there was a cooking competition at NAIT this past weekend. It was the inaugural Varshney Cup. It was a cooking competition with teams of two, and there were six teams, and they each had to cook a three-course dinner for 20 guests and two judges. And I coached one of the teams, and I had an interesting conversation with one of the judges. One of the judges had taken a team of culinary students to those ICA Culinary Olympics to compete in the community catering category, the last Olympics, which I think were just, I think they were right before the pandemic started. Anyways, he was saying that one of the judging criteria at the Olympics has to do with energy usage and efficiency. And so, for instance, like all of our students were cooking in labs that had at least one rationale oven in it. And he said it would be, you'd be docked marks for having that running all day because they heat up so quick. You should have it off when you're not using it and turn it back on right before you need it. And he even went so far as to say, talk about how inefficient cooking with gas is, like on a gas range, and how everything in, like, we're blessed, if you want to call it that, with abundant fossil fuels and natural gas here. And so it makes sense for us to do it kind of economically. But in Europe, they don't have that same abundance. And so everything's on induction. Everything has to be, they monitor their energy usage really closely. So I thought that was really interesting. Right? Isn't that interesting, Shale? 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 Welcome to Food Court. I am Alan Sudeby, and I'm here all by my lonesome, missing my good friend and co-host, Shale McDonald. I'm a chef in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. I love food, and I love to talk about it even when I'm sitting by myself in my basement. So, yes, no Shale this week. Shale is actually quite sick right now. And so besides not having much of a voice, he's also exhausted and needs to rest and get better. So it's just you and me this week, dear listener. So we hope Shale feels better soon, and surely he'll be back in 2 weeks' time so we can resume our regular programming. But for this week, first of all, I do have a piece of follow-up. We half jokingly said that I was going to come with this piece of follow-up this week, and it's regarding our conversation about ooks. I knew ook was an owl. It was a snowy owl, but I wasn't sure what language it was and why it was so important to NAIT. It's the mascot of NAIT. So the actual word is ookpik, and it's the Inuktitut word for snowy owl. But there's a traditional, I guess, like a handicraft toy, like a arts and crafts kind of thing, made by the Inuit, like a doll, basically, of this fuzzy little ookpik. And in the 1960s, these became really popular and common toys for Canadian children. And my mom actually says she remembers her sister Lorna having an ookpik, like it was one of her cherished stuffies. And I think maybe it was used in some trade shows or something, it did become a kind of icon of Canada, well, the Canadian North certainly, but also Canada generally. And I think it was in the 60s during that time when it became the mascot of NAIT. So whether or not that's why there was a chocolate owl on the dessert for the 1992 Team Canada Culinary Olympics, I don't know. Didn't really look like a snowy owl to me. It looked more like it was a great horned owl, but because it had ears. But anyways, that's the official ook follow-up. The actual topic today, though, it's something that I think has come up in conversation before, but this idea of dishes or preparations that are invented after a cook makes a mistake. Basically, a mistake is made, they roll with it, they change something, they adapt, and then a new dish is born. So we're going to talk about that and some classic examples. And to be clear, we're not talking about the kinds of say, like, there's so many of our food preparations that likely, you know, sometime in prehistory came about by mistake. Like, certainly anything involving fermentation almost certainly just came about, I wouldn't even say by mistake, but it's just like it happens naturally without human intervention. We're not talking about that. That does remind me, though, there's a book that I've really been meaning to get a hold of by Ferran Adria. What's it called? It's something like, it's like Neolithic cooking or prehistoric cooking, and it's about the origins of cooking. He probably addresses stuff like that in that book. That's not what we're talking about today. We're talking about specific examples of dishes or preparations from the last, well, from the modern age, basically, from the last few hundred years. I'll say right off the top, a lot of these stories probably aren't true. They're just like things that people like to tell to tourists when they're traveling through different parts of the world. But we'll evaluate them on a case-by-case basis and see whether they are true. We think they could be true or not. So give you a really simple example of one of these accidental dishes. It's simple, but I guess kind of an obscure preparation. But there's a famous cake that was made by a mistake, or has its origin in a mistake. So we'll go all the way back to 19th century Paris, as we often do on this show, and we'll visit the famous pastry cook Félix. And he is in his kitchen. He's trying to make a Savoy sponge cake, which is foamed egg yolks with stiffly whisked egg whites that are folded together to produce like a really light, airy cake. However, unfortunately for Félix, his egg whites aren't whisking up properly. They're not increasing in volume the way he wants. And so he has the idea to add melted butter to the preparation, stir in melted butter, some slivered almonds, and he covers the top of the cake with praline. So it's not what he was trying to make, but he adapted, ended up with something a little bit richer, a little bit denser than the Savoy sponge he was intending to make. They sell it in the shop. One customer in particular loves it. She comes back, orders another one, and asks what that cake was called. And so Félix says manqué, which is the French word for failure. And so now we have gâteau manqué, or the failed cake. I like, it's a dumb story, but I like this story because, first of all, in a previous conversation I shared with Shale, the very first menu that I ever wrote, and it was cake themed. So there was a couple savory cakes, I think fish cakes and something else. And then the actual sweet cake for dessert, I messed up. It didn't rise. I don't know what I did, but I didn't bake it long enough or something. And so on the menu, I called it, screw up crumble cake or something like that. I made a crumbled up the unrisen cake and made a kind of trifle thing. But this was an exact callback to that, because we have our failed cake here. What's kind of frustrating about this story is that, this is still a specialty of Parisian, bakeries. So they still make it. There's a special mold for it called a moule à manquer. But the modern version of it, in a way, kind of like, even though it uses the story and the name of the manquer, they actually do include properly whipped egg whites in the modern version, which is kind of dumb because it kind of defeats it undermines the entire story. But they do that now to improve the texture. So I thought that was kind of ridiculous. But since we're in France, there's actually two very classic French preparations that allegedly were made by accident. So we'll talk about those. And the first one is beurre blanc. So this is our classic sauce made with it's a little bit of reduced vinegar and shallot, into which we whisk, while the liquid is still hot, whisk in cold cubes of butter that lets the butter melt. But because of the temperature control and the agitation, the butter doesn't actually split into the milk solids and liquid. It stays emulsified. So you have a nice, simple, but smooth butter sauce. And it's traditionally served with fish like pike and stuff like that. So the story is that a chef from Nantes named Clemence was making a béarnaise sauce for a marquis. So it was a big, for the Marquis de Goulaine. So it was a high profile event. He's trying to make béarnaise. But he forgets to put the egg yolks in. So he proceeds and invents beurre blanc, and it's awesome. Everybody loves it. And this chef went on to fame and fortune. He opened a restaurant near Nantes, and apparently who would become a famous Parisian chef worked there, learned the secret of the sauce, and brought it to Paris. It's kind of silly to think that if you were making béarnaise that you could proceed to add the butter without realizing that there are no egg yolks in your bowl. That seems kind of weird to me. Also, what's weird is usually when you make béarnaise, you melt the butter, and you can't make beurre blanc from melted butter. You have to use cold butter for it to stay emulsified properly. So even though this story is recorded in La Russe Gastronomique and is supposed to be historical, it doesn't really make very much sense to me. I also like this that béarnaise or hollandaise are right beside beurre blanc. I have a bit of a, not a rant, but some ideas about this, where we, in culinary school, we teach that there are five mother sauces upon which most other important sauces are based. And one of those is hollandaise. But it kind of like, they don't, beurre blanc doesn't have a place in these, like it's not derived from one of the five mother sauces. But really, like, I'm sure Shale will be able to weigh in on this, our next conversation, but in a way, shouldn't beurre blanc be the mother sauce? Like, it has all the ingredients of a hollandaise, but not the egg yolk. So it seems to me like it's like a little bit, it's more of a precursor to all of those sauces than hollandaise. But I mean, the actual kinds of emulsification that's happening in the beurre blanc and the hollandaise are quite different because of the egg yolks and stuff like that. But yeah, it's just awkward that beurre blanc doesn't fall under any of the categories of the five mother sauces, even though it's so important. The other thing that irks me about beurre blanc is that for hollandaise, since it's a mother sauce, we have all of these great variations on it, and they all have names. Like, if you add some concentrated tomato to a hollandaise, you have a choron. If you add orange juice, it's a maltaise, and all these interesting variations that are listed out in the culinary text. But then when you get to beurre blanc, the only variation typically is the beurre rouge, the red butter sauce that's made with red wine instead of white. And maybe there's like a herbed version too, like you make beurre blanc and you fold in herbs. But I really think that we could like think of beurre blanc more generally, like you do a mother sauce, in that all of the variations that you can do to a hollandaise to make béarnaise and all these other sauces, you could do with beurre blanc too. Like, you could make beurre blanc with citrus and make, yeah, like with orange juice and lemon juice. You could make it, certainly, obviously, like anything that you could add to a hollandaise, you could also add to a beurre blanc. But they don't really, I don't know, classically, they don't think of it that way, and they don't really spell it out in the culinary text. But anyways, it's kind of like beurre blanc is like an adoptive mother sauce, not a mother sauce, but an adoptive mother sauce, in that all of the children of hollandaise could be adopted by beurre blanc. Our other really classic French dish that some folks say was invented by accident is our tarte tatin, which is the upside down apple tart, right? So it's apples and butter and sugar put directly into a pie plate, and then the short crust put on top of it for baking. It bakes, the apples get caramelized and delicious, and then when it's done, we turn it upside down so that it presents more like a conventional pie. And so the story, and this is a really silly one to me, but there were the tatin sisters who ran a hotel and restaurant in France in the early 20th century. And so they were making apple pie, and they forgot to put the pie crust in the bottom of the pan. But the apples were already in there. So what do they do? They put the crust on top and bake it that way and turn it upside down. This is a really silly story for a few reasons. First of all, if you really wanted to make a, a conventional apple pie and you put the apples in the pan before the crust, wouldn't you just then realize it and dump the apples out again and wipe the pan out and then put the crust in? Like, what, how difficult is that? You dump the apples into a bowl and you put the crust in the pan, and then anyways. And the other reason it's a silly story is because this, this style of like upside down apple or pear tart is actually, to quote LaRousse, is an ancient specialty of the region. It's found throughout the region and has been made for centuries. It was just made famous by these Tatin sisters at their restaurant. Yes, so that one I think has to be categorically not true. We've got, there's a good one from Austria that has a few different versions, but the dish is called Kaiserschmarrn, which means something like the Kaiser's like scramble, I guess, or something like that. And it's basically a mashed up pancake served with jam. It's not a very attractive dish, but it's tasty and a whole lot of rustic, and very commonly served in the kind of taverns and ski huts and stuff in Austria and Bavaria. So the story is that, like I said, there's a few versions, but most of them involve the last emperor of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, Franz Josef I. And in its simplest form, it's that the cook messed up the pancake. He was making a pancake, and when he was flipping it, it broke. And so he just rolled with it and smashed it up and served it like that in a bowl. And apparently the emperor really liked it. Kind of a silly story, but it is interesting. It's almost like if you can imagine taking pancake batter, but then cooking it the way that you might cook scrambled eggs. So you put it in the pan, you let it start to set, but then before it's set, you start to stir it and break it up and expose the uncooked parts of batter to the hot pan, so that they get, so it comes together just like scrambled eggs. I haven't fully thought this through, but that got me kind of thinking about, like, what other ways could we treat like a pancake batter or a crepe batter the way that we would whisked up eggs? So like, can you make an omelet? Could you make an omelet with pancake batter where you put a thin pancake batter in the pan and then put ham and cheese in it and fold it over, or flip it and then put ham and cheese and fold it over? I think there's lots of traditional preparations like that, like some of the galettes and stuff made in France. Or what about a frittata? What if we're sweating some kind of interesting inclusion in the pan until it's tender, and then adding pancake batter, just so that you have the interesting kind of interior garnishes in it. I haven't fully fleshed out any ideas, but it was just an interesting way to think about treating pancake batter differently than just spooning the pool of round batter into the pan. Other versions of that of the story of the origin of Kaiserschmarrn involve the emperor had a his wife, Elizabeth, or Sissy, as she was called, Sissy. She was notoriously concerned about maintaining a trim figure. She had very peculiar eating habits. And apparently the chef made this dish for her, and she found it too rich, too sweet. And so the emperor kind of quipped, well, let's see what Schmarrn, the chef, has made for us. And he ate it for her. And Schmarrn, besides meaning scramble, was kind of like a dialect word for like a kind of like a trivial thing or like a pish posh kind of thing. Anyways, Kaiserschmarrn is delicious and easy to make. So you can look up recipes online. It's really good. There's also, I think these have come up a few times, but in previous conversations, we talked about the molten chocolate lava cake allegedly being a mistake, possibly from the kitchens of Jean Georges in one of the kitchens in New York, where just a chocolate cake wasn't fully baked, but it was still served. And so it had runny batter in the middle. This is kind of at odds with some people's understanding with the molten chocolate lava cake, where the technique should be that you put a cube of cold set ganache in the center of the raw batter, so that even though you can have fully baked cake batter, but still with the ooey gooey runny interior. So I don't know about if that's true about Jean-Georges just straight up serving an unbaked cake. And then one of the main reasons that this topic even came to mind in the first place is that a couple conversations ago, talking about the splatter plating technique, and of course, Massimo Bottura's dish, Oops, I Dropped the Lemon Tart, came up. And you can watch, it's actually in the very first episode of Chef's Table, which features Osteria Francescana and Chef Massimo. They tell the whole origin story, and maybe it's true, maybe it's not, but it's that, you know, they're Massimo and his sous chef Taka are plating all these desserts, all these lemon tarts. They get to the last two, and sure enough, Taka drops the tart, and you know, all the components are splattered all over the plate. And in his own words, like, he said that he wanted to kill himself, that he wanted to commit harikiri. Like, he was very upset and embarrassed. And then, of course, the ever self-aggrandizing and artistic Massimo says, "No, stop. Look through my fingers." And he holds up his fingers like as if it's the viewfinder of a camera. "It's beautiful. We will remake the dessert to look just like these." And I'm not saying it didn't happen. It's just a funny, it's a great story. It's a great story, and a good idea. It's a really fun idea. But everything in Chef's Table is so dramatic and over the top. I really get a kick out of it. I was trying to think of examples of maybe small examples of mistakes happening in the kitchens that I've worked, where we roll with it and end up with something new or interesting. Most of the ones that I think of have to do with burning something, but then finding out that it tastes quite good burnt. Like, what are examples of that? We, like, a really simple one. So at Elm, making sandwiches, we had these like oven roasted tomatoes on some menu items. And one day they stay in the oven too long. The tomatoes burn, not to ash, but like they were black on the outside and still had some concentrated tomato juiciness in the middle. Just the way they looked, though, they couldn't be used just as oven dried tomatoes on a sandwich. People would say, "Oh, this is a burnt tomato." But then Nate Box had the great idea to blend them into aioli and make burnt tomato aioli. And this actually became a staple, something that we used many times over the years. It's such a great flavor. It's such like a really concentrated tomato flavor. And that little taste of the bit of black tomato is actually in moderation, and when it's kind of tempered by the richness of mayo or aioli, it's actually really, really tasty. And I know I'll have to get Shale to fill us in, but I remember a conversation where Shale was talking about turning some kind of, it was intentionally burning toast or something like that to puree it, or to put it into a custard, I think it was. So it was like a burnt toast custard of some sort. I'm sure if I'm remembering that right or not, but yeah, there's kind of a bit of a trend, or I don't know if you want to call it that, but this idea that some things actually taste quite good when they're burnt or borderline burnt. There was the famous burnt cabbage dish at Model Milk in Calgary. Even like cauliflower, like we've talked about roasted cauliflower dishes a few times. You can take it really, really far before it starts to be unpalatable. You can get really, really dark colors on it. And we talked about the burnt carrots, like the fire roasted carrots a few times. But I would love to know if when Shale returns, if he has any examples of totally messing something up in the kitchen, but then actually it turning out okay, and or bringing a new preparation or dish to the kitchen. I would also be curious if any of the listeners who work in kitchens have had something like that happen. It's interesting that so many of these have to do, they're from the pastry kitchen. That makes sense to me because most of my mistakes happen in pastry because I'm not very good at it. But, yeah, I would love to know if anyone out there has a mistake that became an interesting dish or preparation. Those are the examples I have for today, but I wanted to, because Shale is sick and he's not feeling good and he's down, I thought he really likes to end the episode with jokes sometimes. So just before I got on to record this, I got out the company's coming books, flipped through, and just pulled out some jokes. And I'm just going to read them. And so hopefully when Shale listens to this, it'll cheer him up, okay? I got a few. Here they come, from Company's Coming. When college students were advised they were to have a blood test the next day, they stayed up half the night studying for it. Maybe when Shale's editing this, he can like put in a little cymbal tap there to, so that everyone knows that the joke happened. Here's the next one. She couldn't care less for a man's company. Unless he owns it, that is. Next. An illegally parked frog gets towed away. Insert laugh track. And here's the last one. Our last Company's Coming joke. An experienced drinker decided to write a song about drinking, but he couldn't make it past the first two bars. Ba-dum-tsh. That's our show. Shale, I hope you feel better soon. We miss you. And thanks for listening. Have a great couple weeks, everyone.
Thanks for listening to Food Court, a podcast recorded in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. Food Court is hosted by Alan Sutterby and Shale McDonald. Theme music by Ryan and Shale McDonald. Make sure to subscribe to Food Court in Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, or in your favorite podcast player. We love to hear from our listeners. Please drop us a line at feedback@foodcourt.fm or find us on Instagram at Food Court Podcast. If you want to spread the word, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. We'll be back in 2 weeks with a fresh new episode. Thanks for listening.